I'd like to start the audio today. I guess first, welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary and Video for March 31st, the last day of the first quarter. It is 5 p.m. Pacific Summer Time. I apologize for the late recording. I was in Las Vegas earlier this morning, and I'm really just off the plane. Now, part of the reason I was there is because I sit on the board of a trust company, and they were bidding for the business of a university endowment. And what came out of that meeting I thought was very interesting. The endowment is being managed by some of the founders of the university, and therefore they don't particularly have a great deal of investment expertise on the board. What that has resulted in is that they have been in cash since 2009. They lost some money in 2009. The trauma of that experience has influenced the investment policy since, and they have been in cash for the vast majority of the period since, and that is despite the fact that we have had a massive move in the stock market. Well, what can we conclude from that? As behavioral analysts, we can think about that and think, where are we in terms of the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets? 2009 represented massive disbelief that anything would ever get better, and it has taken a long time to convince people. But many investors are obviously back in the market. The stock market is up over 200% since then. So when we think about that, we can no longer say that there's a lot of money on the sidelines. Obviously, a lot of that money has been committed, and most particularly committed since the presidential election, because that removed some of the uncertainty and created a more business-friendly environment in general, which would have allowed businesses to at least make some decisions about what they're going to do, and certainly that there aren't going to be higher taxes. Quite whether there's going to be tax reform is another question entirely. But what we can perhaps conclude is that we are certainly in the acceptance phase right now, that people who thought that there was nothing but risk in the stock market are beginning to reassess, they're beginning to look outside, and they're beginning to inquire as to how they might be able to get a better return on their money. Now, that is indicative of at least that we're in the acceptance phase, but potentially that we are moving into the phase that could be described as the mania phase, where people get really very enthusiastic, and then the price of assets gets considerably beyond the realm of what might be considered normal. This week we've posted quite a number of really quite interesting reports, and there were two in particular that I thought were worthy of mention. One was one by James Montier, and in that, he talks about the Shiller P/E ratio, the cyclically adjusted P/E ratio, and that stocks could no longer be considered cheap or even fair valued, but that they are getting increasingly expensive because that valuation is at its highest level. It's in fact only been exceeded twice in history. Once was on in 1929, and the other time was in 1999. And that is a fact. We certainly have evidence of this is a pretty elevated level. But what can we see from the chart? I've taken this from multiple.com. This is Shiller's own website. On the two previous occasions when the Shiller PE ratio got to those important peaks in 1929 and in 2009, it accelerated in a dramatic fashion to get there. And now let's ask a simple question. Is it accelerating today? And the answer is no. No, it is not accelerating today. Is it high? Yes, but it is not accelerating. And then perhaps we can say, yes, this is a high PE ratio by historical standards. We could make perhaps a fallacious argument that this time really is different. In fact, this time is always different, but usually not in the way that people think. But the more important point is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3? Because those clear accelerations were type 1 endings. And when they turned, Well, then that was a clear indication that something has really changed in the market. And the price or the P/E ratio is not yet accelerating. That doesn't mean that it can't accelerate. And if we look at the way that the market is functioning, then we might be able to say that maybe this market could accelerate. Maybe we are going to see this market breaking up and out, and perhaps even move to a new all-time high, and that we would have another bubble. That doesn't mean that we're going to have another bubble now. It could take a couple of years, it could take a number of years to get to that level. What we do know is that this is a really quite a benign environment, and that there is ample potential for valuations to increase from here. When we look at the long-term chart of the S&P 500, then it has broken up in a way from this 2-year range. It's already had a very impressive breakout from that long-term range between about or just below 1500, and really that lasted for 13 years. When we look at it just over the last decade, there is a mild short-term overbought condition, and this has been a particularly impressive advance in the first quarter. Could we then have some pause and consolidation in the next quarter? It's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility that so far within this range that began at the beginning of March, there is a progression of lower rally highs. This has been an impressive rally from the lows that we saw at the end of last week, but it has not broken the progression of lower rally highs. The Nasdaq, however, has continued to outperform and is right back at its peak. It was just in mildly negative territory today, but it did hit a new all-time high before it pulled back. The biggest dynamic that we've seen on the chart, though, is that downside Q reversal that we saw a week ago, and or I think it's more like 2 weeks ago. And we are still in a rangy environment. We're just at the upper side of the range. It would really need to break away and clear the 5450 area to really suggest that we are breaking away from what has really just been a 1 month range. Even if we go back and look at between August and really the beginning of December, that was a pretty lengthy range, and we had a lengthy range, or at least a multi-month range before that as well. So if this is going to remain a consistent chart, then we can probably anticipate that there is going to be a multi-month range, and that we are towards the upper side of the range right now. It is also worth considering that we are at the tail end of what is seasonally the best time for stocks, and that it does get a little bit more difficult from here. So the potential is that we do get a more volatile environment, or we get some more choppy trading in the next while than we have perhaps been used to. Now, when we then think there was another report, and it talked about the fact that the supply of shares has contracted considerably over the last while. Over the last, I think, 16, 17 years, the supply of stock on the US markets has contracted, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is that we have tighter regulation, that there is a considerable onus on publicly listed companies to comply with a large number of regulations that increases costs, and it represents a headache for a lot of these companies, so they don't have that incentive. The fact that we have such low interest rates is a factor in the ability of private equity firms to be able to raise capital, and then they are able to fund private companies so that through not just one round but multiple rounds of funding, so that the size of private companies is considerably larger than it would have been previously. So that is, and then of course you have buybacks. Buybacks, I contend, are one of the clearest conduits for monetary policy to feed into the stock market. Companies can borrow at historically low rates, and they can use that money to fund buybacks. The chart that we have in front of us right now is the PKW Buyback Achievers Index, and it has been underperforming the S&P 500. And I've got this chart. Let me just pull that over. Like they say, this is one I prepared earlier. And we can see that the PKW index, despite the fact that in nominal terms it still has a reasonably impressive performance, has been underperforming the S&P 500 really since the first quarter of 2015. It bounced pretty impressively after the election, but has lost ground relative to the wider market since. When we look at this relative chart, the best period of time to own the PKW was between about early 2008 and early 2014. And we know, as students of the market, that there was an important event at the beginning of 2014. It was when the Fed began to taper. And when we look at government bonds, they are holding in the region of 2.5%, having rallied, and of course that was a major pullback by the price, which resulted in a substantial move in the yield earlier, or I guess late last year. Much of that overbought condition has been unwound, and now we're seeing, if we zoom in just for the last year, we can see quite clearly that this is the lower side of the range, and what happens next is going to give us a lot of intelligence as to just how strong the bond market is. Much of that overextension relative to the trend mean has already been unwound. So if the mean is going to represent resistance for prices or support for yields, then we're going to see an additional bounce from these levels. Something that I think is, and for example, if we take the federal funds rate, which right now is 1%, and we look at 12-month yields. Well, if we look at 12-month yields, we're going to get a yield of 1.0164%. Now, that is despite the fact that, okay, James Bullard today said that they're in no great rush to raise interest rates. But what we see in the bond market is that the bond market is unwilling to price in any increases in the federal funds rate. The bond market is perhaps the greatest example that we have in the world right now of the boy who cried wolf, like in Aesop's fables. The Fed said so many times that it was going to raise rates and then didn't do it, that the bond market has become conditioned to only price in interest rate hikes when it has to. So we look at this chart and we can see a progression of higher reaction lows. And we can see also that if you look at the 2 year, then we get this first step above the base. And over 2 years, bond investors are only willing to price in a quarter point increase. Now, that's pretty extraordinary that the bond market is thinking that the Fed is only going to raise rates once between now and early March 2019. And that will tell us that this really is an environment where the bond market is gun shy, that anyone who has shorted the rallies, anyone who has been willing to bet that the Fed would raise interest rates, has lost money. And therefore, they're trading very conservatively. But what that means is that when the Fed does raise rates, then they have to rush. They have to price it in immediately, and then that represents you're really quite a considerable risk, because there is no allocation in the pricing of bonds right now for additional inflation, and we can't discount the potential that there will be inflation. Right, the reality is that the economy is growing, albeit modestly, but that growth is picking up internationally, that the prices at the factory door in China are rising. And if China could export deflation, it can export inflation. Wages are starting to rise. And we're seeing that in a number of the major conurbations in the US, that the minimum wage is going to rise to $15 an hour. Now, $15 an hour is a lot of money, and it has particular effect on the people that are already earning $15 an hour, because if someone is going to get $15 for flipping burgers, not only is that going to enhance the potential for automation, but that the person who is now on $15 is going to want 25. So that is going to put upward pressure on wages. And if you have higher wages, and most particularly if you have people asking for more money for doing the same work, then that is going to stoke inflation. And that isn't being reflected in the bond market at all. But perhaps we could see that it is being reflected in the stock market. The stock market is one of the better hedges against inflation. The stock market is going up. Stock market is going up because they have already priced in the potential for lower interest rates, excuse me, for lower corporate taxes, for repatriation of overseas funds, for an infrastructure push, and potentially even I guess a streamlining of the tax environment in the US would have enormous beneficial effects on the economy. When we turn our attention to Europe, then this was a very big week for Europe. We've had really a lot of news with the UK triggering Article 50 of the Nice Treaty and exiting the EU. Brussels wants the UK to commit to paying whatever it had committed to paying previously into the European budget. Germany is warning against aggressive tax cuts in order to boost the UK's competitiveness, and saying that any kind of trade deal would be conditional on the UK not wanting to compete. What we can see here is that the pound is currently trading at 125.50. The pound has strengthened after the announcement of Brexit. We can see also by the fact that as the defensive way that many European or Eurozone countries have reacted to Brexit suggests that they have as much to lose, if not more, than the UK, because they're going to find it very difficult to act in a competitive way or to react in a competitive way to any kind of measures taken by the UK to boost their own competitiveness. And that is part of the reason that the euro this week has formed a downside key reversal from the region of the 200-day moving average. I can zoom in on that just to give us a better view of that downside key. It got right up to the region of the trend mean, traded above it very briefly, and finished on the low of the week. Having unwound that overextension relative to the trend mean, this now represents a risk for the Eurozone. If the euro is pulling back in a dynamic fashion like that, then that's generally good news for the stock market. The stock market has been in robust form over the last few weeks. You, of course, don't buy countries, you buy companies, and companies will benefit from having a weaker currency. We have election schedules in the Eurozone. There is the French election in April. But before that, we're going to have the Turkish referendum. And Erdogan is looking to enhance his political power. the lira has strengthened from about 4 to above 4.5 over the last couple of months, but its advance has really been arrested over the last month because of continued angst in the West about just exactly what is going to happen in Turkey. And the Eurozone is in a tough place because they are literally bribing Turkey to house or to at least contain the refugee crisis. So they can't be too vocal in their complaints about exactly what is going on in Turkey. The US is under no such duress, and we have seen the criticism of these measures being voiced additionally in here today. Quite apart from what's going on in Turkey, then we should also look at Greece, because Greece is going to run out of money in July. That could act as a lightning rod for the German election, which is in October. Part of the reason that the Greek bailout is such an important consideration is that the IMF doesn't want to sign up to supporting it again, because they believe that the conditions that have been imposed on Greece are too onerous, that Greece hasn't a prayer of being able to pay back the money that it has borrowed, regardless of what it does to its economy. But Germany can't even begin to talk about forgiving some of that debt until after the election, and that creates a problem. So we have also had a pretty quiet time in Europe, and not least because it's been winter. It's hard to walk across mountains in the winter, but the weather is starting to warm up. There is the potential that the refugee crisis is going to intensify over the summer months, and that could also represent a threat for the German election. Meanwhile, the DAX is a total return index, and it is benefiting from the weakness of the euro, and it is now testing its highs. The last time it hit this peak was in April of 2015. That peak was also associated with euro weakness, and this was a big downward key reversal for the euro this week. So there is the potential that we're going to have an additional rally by euro-denominated assets in the short term. The other market that I think is worth watching is Japan, for much of the same reason. The Nikkei was weaker in here today. It is now right at the lower side of its range, and this is an important level. A lot is going to hinge on just how strong the yen is going to be. Now, the yen has unwound the overextension relative to the trend mean. It is trading right now in the region of that mean. If the yen strengthens through 110, well, then the potential for a pullback is an additional pullback on the stock market cannot be discounted. The currency that has perhaps done best in this quarter has been the Indian rupee. It has had the best quarter since 1975, and this has a clear break of the dollar's uptrend. The dollar has been appreciating steadily for a very long time, and I think actually if we look at it the other way around, let me see, it would be USD-INR. Sorry. The INR-USD, and we see this downtrend for the rupee. If we look at that on a logarithmic scale, then we're going to get a very different picture. The rupee has done nothing but trend lower for a very long time. And I think we can go back quite a bit further, go back all the way to the early 1970s. We could really say that there was a brief period in 2006 through 2008 that the rupee appreciated, and Outside of that, it has just about always gone down until recently. This is a substantial move. We've broken the progression of lower rally highs, and this is an emphatic breakout. That is lending additional impetus to people buying Indian assets, and the Nifty has continued to hold above this 9,000 level. It is not going up in a dynamic fashion. There is this argument going on about just how expensive the Indian market is, and on a PE basis it probably is, but on a price to book basis it's back to where it was in 2008. India has just introduced the GST. They've had the demonetization in the last 5 months. It took some time to recover from that, and it looks like it has now been achieved. They've introduced 4G, going from 2G to 4G in a very short period of time. Reliance Industries has spent a great deal of time building that network, and now that it has finished, the share has taken off. They've gone from the capital expenditure to the or to reaping some of the rewards from that expenditure, and the share is really reflecting that. That's a great example too of how emerging markets can skip whole steps in terms of their development. That India has got the opportunity now to get mobile banking without having to build banking branches. One of the benefits of mobile banking is that, and anyone who has children will be able to attest to this, that you do not have to be literate to figure out how to use a smartphone. So many smartphones today have fingerprint technology, so you don't need to be able to log in. You don't need to log in either. For example, when I checked in for my flight back this afternoon on the Southwest Airlines app, I was able to log in with my fingerprint. That's important from the perspective of those that are trying to build out the banking sector. Excuse me, I need to sneeze. Sorry about that. Well, if 40% of the Indian population is illiterate, and how do you get those people into the economy? How do you supply them with goods and services? Well, by giving them smartphones might be a simple answer. That with 4G connectivity and affordable smartphones, they could have online banking. And that is perhaps where the Indian government is going. There is ample potential for the banking sector to do very well if they can roll out these kinds of technologies. And it is not like India doesn't have a lot of people that have got great experience in developing technology. But the Bombay Banks Index has been leading the wider market for a considerable period of time. Well, if India is beginning to show signs of returning to life, the A-share index has been particularly inert over really much of the last year and a half. When we look at that on the daily chart, then it has been a reasonably choppy, but it has held the progression of higher reaction lows
Sorry,
since. And that was my Siri that thinks I'm talking to her. Now, what we can see here is that the A-share index has been trending higher in a mild manner, going from 2,900 to 3,400 in really the last year. But it has done so in a jerky manner, and largely what we might consider a manufactured manner. The Chinese are contending with a currency that they need to go lower, but they don't want it to go lower all at once. And it is still in a reasonably consistent downtrend against the dollar, and here's the dollar going up against it. We are in now a process of consolidation. And the seven area represents an area of support for the renminbi. it would really, though, need to sustain a move below 6.8 to question the dollar's dominance. With the euro going down, we have some evidence, at least, of the dollar index finding support around this 100 area and bouncing relatively impressively from the region of the trend mean this week. Now, when we look at gold prices, then gold is trading around $1,250, and it is certainly in its favor that it has held that area despite the fact that the dollar has been reasonably firm. When we look at it on the weekly chart, there was this massive reaction against prevailing trend in early 2016, and that's a type 2 trend ending characteristic, so it's a type 2 bottom. Type 2s are so very often followed by periods of right-hand extension, where the crowd has to be convinced that something really has changed. And there is the potential that that is the case. Gold does best when inflation is outpacing central banks raising interest rates. And the bond market would say that, well, since the bond market isn't pricing in any interest rate hikes, that, but we know that there are inflationary pressures out there, that then there is the potential that that may indeed be the case, that inflation could become an issue. And it is looking increasingly likely that the low that we saw at the beginning of this year was a higher reaction low for gold prices, and that they have just firmed again from the $1,200 area, so that there is the potential that we are in a rangy phase between $1,000 and $1,400. Then the question is whether it can gain the impetus to break above $1,400. And personally, I think it is too early to say that just yet. We've often regarded silver as high beta gold, and silver has firmed perhaps a little bit more impressively. It also gave up more of its advance, but it has firmed and it is back testing its highs around the 1825 area. At the high, I guess, was at 1850, but it is firming from that $18 area, and that is positive. I think a lot of people will be looking at the gold mining sector. Gold mines did not offer upside leverage to the gold price, but they are performing, and they are underperforming the gold price right now. Gold is back testing its recent highs, and the gold shares aren't. But they do have a higher reaction low here. They have found support above $20, and really a sustained move below that level would be required to question that this isn't going to push up additionally from here, and particularly if gold prices can clear the $1,250 area. I think everybody is looking at oil prices, and oil has bounced from 50 and it is back up to almost $53. When we look at this on the weekly chart, it has bounced from the region of the trend mean, more or less the region of the upper side of the underlying range, but it has certainly dipped back into that range. This is not a consistent chart pattern. There is additional potential that some of that oversold condition can be unwound, and it really would need to sustain a move below the recent lows to confirm a supply-dominated environment. We do have an OPEC meeting in about another 6 weeks. The question is, does OPEC have the willingness to cut additional supply that might be required to push prices higher? We know that a great deal of additional unconventional oil and gas becomes economic at around $60. So there is a headwind for prices to be sustained above $60. I think it is accurate to now think of the unconventional oil and gas, particularly in the USA, to represent the marginal cost of production. I think that that is perhaps the most important point about energy, that OPEC's ability to swing the market has been curtailed to a certain extent, because they might be able to produce at a very low level, but that that does not represent their break even because they have so many additional costs, and not least on the social front, that have to be met. Whereas unconventional oil and gas isn't responsible to anybody other than its shareholders. When we take a step back and we look at the longer term, then I think that we really do have to consider that the news is filled with bad news. And yet, there are some very positive things, that the US banking sector has been recapitalized. It has done enormously well since November of last year. Then we do have a technological innovation. And it is not just about hype. There are a significant number of these companies are doing very well. And they are among the largest companies in the world now. A lot of people are worried about protectionism, but that is an amorphous term, because what we are already seeing is that once technology is created, that it goes global almost instantaneously. And that continues to allow emerging markets to increase, to skip whole stages of development. And we've seen that in India with the 4G evolution. And we are in a lower energy price environment. I personally don't see any chance of oil prices sustaining a move back to $100. It doesn't mean that they can't get back to $100, but that they will not sustain that move. That would unleash masses of new supply. We're looking today at people beginning to argue that they could unleash horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing in Alaska, but saying that it is a bit too expensive at today's levels. Well, if we were to see prices double, then that kind of supply coming back out of Alaska would represent more than 1 million barrels a day that would be flooding back into the market. So these are really significant moves. These are things that could help depress oil prices for the foreseeable future. So when you start to think about lower energy prices and technological innovation, those are the kinds of things that will contribute to growth and keep a lid on inflation. The inflation isn't coming from technology, and it's not coming from commodities. Inflation is likely to be led higher by wages and potentially from competitive currency market devaluation. So we do have the potential that we could move into an inflationary period despite the fact that energy prices are lower. So there is really a lot to think about. I think we are still in a benign environment, but that we have had a particularly strong, an impressive move over the last 6 months, and that we are due some pause and consolidation, and that the potential for a larger reactionary period at some time in the second or third quarter is certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.